want to take a couple of minutes to introduce Tools for Change and QPIRG, which is the organization that puts it on. My name is Helen Hudson. I'm one of the two coordinators of QPIRG Concordia. QPIRG is the Quebec Public Interest Research Group. It's located across the street and runs a number of activist events and projects, some of which are on an ongoing basis and some of which are events like tonight on any number of social justice and environment issues. One of those projects is Tools for Change, which is a series of activist workshops and events like tonight, panel discussions, talks, movie series, that sort of thing, based at giving people the tools and the information to go out into their communities and do activism. Tonight's panel discussion is Confronting Globalization, Strategies for Alternatives and Action. It's a follow-up to another event that happened about a week and a half ago, the ABCs of Globalization. Last week's event focused on sort of an introduction to the issues, and tonight the assumption is that we're coming here already convinced of why corporate globalization is bad, and we're going to be talking about sort of strategies for action, for change, for resisting corporate globalization, and the issues that we talked about last week. I guess without any further ado, we're going to get to the topic tonight, Confronting Globalization. We've got five panelists tonight. First of all, we're going to hear from Serena Natter and Brian Sharp, who are both activists with Resist FTAA Action Committee in Toronto. Serena and Brian have been involved in Toronto's radical communities, involved in organizations such as Dow Communications, OPERG Toronto, the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, and are currently mobilizing for the FTAA meeting that's happening later this month in Toronto. So they're going to be talking about that. Next, we'll hear from Jaggi Singh, who's just recently come back from Seattle and Olympia, where he's participated in an anti-World Trade Organization conference on trade, labor, and the environment. He's also been an organizer with Operation Salami, which is a local anti-MAI group, as well as groups in Vancouver that mobilized against the APEC summit in 97. And then finally, we'll hear from Pierre Héricon, who's an organizer with Attaque Québec, and is also working to raise awareness about the World Trade Organization. So I'm going to hand it over first to Serena and Brian. Each presenter will have about 15 minutes, and then we'll open it up to discussion at the end.
Hi, so we're from Resist FTAA. It's a group that's been together for about a month, and it's called an ad hoc action committee to organize against the FTAA. And we're going to sort of share our two 15-minute blocks. But basically, Brian is going to talk about what the FTAA actually is, more specifically, and how it fits into general corporate globalization and privatization. And then I'm going to go on to talk about what's going on in Toronto and some general tactical thoughts about organizing against corporate globalization and agreements like the FTAA. So Brian's going to start.
Okay. Let's see. I'm supposed to start off with a joke, Jackie says, but we just drove down here from Toronto. We're in the midst of organizing for next week, is the whole week of action against the FTAA. So I apologize if I seem a little tired. The FTAA is called the Free Trade Area of the Americas. And what that is, it's an agreement like NAFTA, like APEC, like the MAI. But it's a trade agreement which is going to be extended to all of the Americas. So from Brazil up the way to Canada, throughout the Caribbean, all the countries except Cuba. So 34 nations in total. The FTAA is based off of NAFTA, so that's the sort of founding principles. And it also, within its, within its agenda is to accept all the things which are going to be in the WTO talks, all the multilateral agreement on investment talks, also things that were discussed in the GATT rounds, NAFTA, the FTAA. So basically, all the other trade agreements which are out there, it sort of accepts the items which are in those trade agreements and wants to build upon them further. The FTAA is, a lot of people may be hearing about it for the first time tonight. You might have heard about it a little bit over email, but basically it's been negotiated since 1994. So it's been around for quite a while, but it's another one of those trade agreements which nobody hears about because there's so many of them going on and there's so much stuff going on among the corporate world. So what we're trying to do is to get some about this raised. So it started in 1994, and it's due to be completed by the year 2005. But there's a midpoint of that, and that's the year 2000, so coming up very shortly. And the midpoints, basically what the agreement is that by the end of the year 2005, they'll have completed this big free trade area throughout the Americas, but by the year 2000, they should have made considerable progress towards already getting to that point, so that all the countries will have already started to privatize much of their social sector, you know, education, hospitals, whatnot. So it's not like there's this agreement at the very end that when it gets signed, all the stuff is going to radically start to change. Countries are already working on it right now, and we all see what's happening, what's happening to the education system up here, to what's going on down in Colombia with, the privatization of the telecommunications industry. Nortel is reaping big profits down there. So it's going on continuously, and it's all sort of, a lot of this is taking place around the FTAA talks. So I guess that's it. Now, the basic goal of the FTAA, as they state it, is to unite the economies of the Western Hemisphere into a single free trade arrangement. They say it's between the 34 democracies, so excluding Cuba. I guess the basic goal is to sort of give it a government face, what's going on, this whole corporate agenda, this privatization bit, is to give it a sort of a legitimate government public face so that, it's not just corporations doing things behind the scenes and sort of lobbying individual governments and for each specific project, but we have this legitimate movement towards the free market rule, I guess. And the other thing about the FTAA is that not only do they want to totally legitimize, but they want the governments to facilitate the movement of privatization, the movement of the corporate sector controlling a lot of public policy. So they want the FTAA is also set up as sort of a clearinghouse of trade agreements within the Americas. So there's right now there's the Mercosur, there's a bilateral agreement between Canada and Chile. There's like all these different trade agreements. The FTAA the FTAA is a clearinghouse where all these different trade agreements are put together, and people can sort of access them easily, so that businesses who want to do international setups, in Chile, can easily go to the FTAA structure and sort of know what trade agreements are going on there and how close they are to being harmonized, which is to the trade agreements which we're used to in Canada, that type of thing. So that's the main sort of thing the FTA about the other goal of it is that they're trying to sell it to the public and to I think in the Globe and Mail the other day Pierre Pettigrew, the trade minister, said his mission is to put a human face on globalization and to make it sound a little bit more appealing to the public so that it's not just about business we're talking about anymore. It's about all our lives. It's about everything we use, healthcare, education, whatnot. If you look at the FTA plan of action, there's four main parts to it, and one part is all about free trade. It's all about intellectual property rights, all the investment regulations, all that type of thing. But then there's other parts in there. So we have preserving and strengthening the community of democracies of the Americas. So within preserving democracy, they have things like combating corruption, combating illegal drugs, stopping international terrorism. All these, interesting. Basically, they want to make it look like they're fighting the bad guys out there, and there's all these sort of horrible people out there which are eroding democracy. And this free trade area of the Americas is going to take a stand and make sure that democracy is strong, which we've heard quite a bit before. They've also said that they want to eradicate poverty and discrimination in our hemisphere. So they talk about universal access to education. They talk about creating a group of white helmets, which are an emergency volunteer team, and mobilizing groups of volunteers throughout the Americas to go to the aid of sort of problem areas in the Americas. But within all of these sections, you see the main sort of goals at the beginning, like the universal access, creating 100% literacy in all the countries by the year 2005. But within how they're going to get to those goals, the bottom line is that they feel that the private sector should be involved in all of this, that government should move more towards involving the private sector in all the in all these things and giving them more of a role in this. So, you know, what was a quote here for the education one is under the bit about universal access to education, it says they'll make education more relevant to the needs of the market and the employees, and they'll also provide a forum for the business community, donors and international organizations to reform educational policies and focus resources more efficiently. So, you know, when you get down into the agreement, you see sort of what they mean by all this, all these kind-hearted words they say at the beginning. So, okay, so that's you know, that's what the FTA is about, and they claim that it's, this is the first free trade agreement, the first trade agreement like this of its kind that actually involves civil society input, and they have actually gone out there to try to get input from what they call civil society, which includes businesses, includes union type groups, some larger environmental organizations, and but the groups that they include are what they call civil groups, who are groups who are willing to sort of compromise and work with them, and sort of have a common objective in mind. So basically, they take the groups which aren't pushing so hard and marginalize the more radical groups who are sort of out there to, you know, who are opposing a lot of the agenda, the corporate agenda, and they sort of smooth it all out. So they've involved a lot of the civil society sector in this, and that's where all this wording comes from in the agreements. And I guess what I'll end off with there is that the basic idea is that, you know, the FTAA and APEC and NAFTA and all those other things, it's not like a free trade, and it's not a free trade agreement for everybody. It's not globalization for everyone. What it is a free trade agreement for corporations and for the elites and the people who have all the money and all the power already. You know, one thing I say quite often is that, you know, the free trade agreements are letting capital and business and investors move freely across borders and making this one, you know, big continent for investors to go back and forth. But for the people that don't have the money, they're isolated in areas, and it's getting harder and harder for people to move across borders. And they're also being attacked, you know, whether it be like, you know, shelters are disappearing or, you know, healthcare is disappearing. So the poor are being isolated, capital's flowing back and forth freely, and they're about what agreements are about. There's a move from legitimizing that and sort of strengthening their power hold. So there you go. Do you have anything to say about that?
No, I think.
Okay.
Just keep going.
All right.
We'll change our strategy.
Okay. So, and the other thing I was going to talk about was just globalization in general. And one thing, on November 4th, which I guess Serena will get into a bit more, but it's also been declared the International Day in solidarity with the Zapatistas, who everyone probably is aware of that, and the Zapatistas in Chiapas, Mexico, who officially sort of launched their resistance as the Zapatistas when NAFTA was signed. Because NAFTA did a lot to sort of repeal a lot of the rights of indigenous peoples in Mexico. And so November 4th, because of the FTAA, there's going to be an International Day of Solidarity to sort of show that this stuff is continuing to happen. The FTA is going to be doing more to affect indigenous land rights within the Americas. And that's not just in Chiapas, that's up here as well. So there's that. And I think that's where I'm ending up there.
All right. So. Okay, I'll take over. There goes sharing. Sharing doesn't work. So I'm going to talk about now what's going on in Toronto and maybe try and convince some of you guys to come. But so basically it's next week and, it's structured. Okay. Prior to the FTAA talks, the FTAA talks are on November 4th and November 5th, which is at the end of next week. And prior to that is a conference of the Americas Business Forum. And the Americas Business Forum is, a conference of 1,000 business leaders from all countries in North, South, Central America, and the Caribbean, and they're all getting together to talk about what recommendations they want to give to the trade ministers that are going to negotiate the FTAA. So that's on November 1st to 3rd. And on the 3rd, the trade ministers and the business leaders are going to get together for a nice little meeting, and they're going to talk about what the business people leaders talked about and what they're going to tell the trade ministers that they want in the FTAA, their recommendations. So that's basically what's going on next week. And so firstly, on the Sunday, October 31st, a group called the Metro Network for Social Justice, which is a group in Toronto that's sort of a coalition or a networking group of all different groups in Toronto, they're organizing a rally on October 31st, which is Halloween, in order to scare off the evil trade demons that are coming to our town. So it's sort of supposed to be a building rally in order to allow people to, like, there's a whole bunch of speakers that day, and allow people to get educated about the FTAA and hopefully motivated to come out to some of the events that week. So that's happening on the 31st. And then also the Metro Network for Social Justice is organizing on November 4th from 7:30 to 9 a.m. A demonstration against the actual finance ministers that are coming to town, and basically tell them to leave and that we don't want the FTAA. And at that rally, they're going to sort of have a mock trial of trying to basically arrest all the trade ministers. I think that's what it is.
Yeah, they're going to try them for aiding and abetting the corporate sector in
right.
the stuff that they do well.
So there's going to be that rally. So the group that we're from, which is Resist FTAA, formed about a month ago, and we formed sort of because we felt like the organizing that was happening by the MNSJ wasn't necessarily going to push as hard as we would want to, or push an analysis that was sort of as holistic or radical as we wanted. So we decided to start another group. And originally the intent of our group was just to participate in what they were doing, but sort of try and put a more rabble-rousing, radical sort of spin on it and do some of our own education. But actually, once we called the meetings and we started getting together, it was about 10 or 12 of us. We got sort of really excited and full of our own ambition. And so we started organizing a lot more stuff than that. So we decided to choose the America's Business Forum as our target and not the FTAA talks. Basically because, first of all, on the 3rd, that seemed like a good target because they were both the ABF people and the FTA people were going to be together, and also because that just seems to be and basically is where the real power is, which is all these business leaders from all across the Americas coming together. So we decided to choose that as a target, and we started, the first thing that we did was that we made posters, and we hadn't yet planned our demonstration for the 3rd. And so we made all these educational posters about what the FTA would do to education, what the FTA would do to indigenous rights, what it would do in general to healthcare, how it would affect sweatshops and cheap labor and everything like that. So we started making those posters, and we were having meetings about once a week and twice a week. And there's actually samples of some of these posters at the back, so we photocopied some. So if you want to pick up some at the end, that would be good. You could just look at them for examples of what we did. So we did that, and then we're also planning on November the 3rd to have this rally against the America's Business Forum and the trade leaders, and hopefully we're not exactly sure what's going to happen there, but we're going to have a rally and try to be really loud and get as close to them as we can. And then also what we're doing, sort of tying into what the Metro Networks for Social Justice is that we're going to encourage people to play tricks on the trade ministers. So we're going to give out some information about where they might be staying or what type of things they might be doing and events they might be going to, and encouraging people to sort of go and find them and confront them or play little tricks on them. Like, I don't know, maybe we thought of some ideas, like throw things at them or prank phone call them or whatever. So we're going to, but it's also just sort of the idea is to just be like, we don't want them here, and like we're going to sort of curse them, and hopefully their trip to Toronto will suck because we don't want them to come back.
I have to say, we have this one idea of delivering burning bags of shit to all to all the different trade ministers or corporations staying at their hotels.
And we kept trying to think up ideas for tricks at our meetings, and Brian just kept thinking up that idea, and we're just like, what are you talking about? How do you even do that? But anyway, so we're going to try and play tricks or sort of give an atmosphere of general anger towards these trade ministers. And we're also going to use the October 31st rally to spread information about our demo and the type of analysis that we're talking about. And then also we're going to try and do something that is sort of a welcoming committee type of thing, where we're going to get a group of people together and we're going to go to where some trade ministers might be, and we're going to welcome them to our town. And basically we're just going to be like very, very, very excited to see them. And we're hopefully going to have some kind of signs that say like, thank you for ruining the environment, or like, oh, we love having lower wages and no benefits and stuff like that. And just go and be really nice to them and sort of like try and make them a bit uncomfortable and confused.
Aggressively shake hands.
Yeah, okay. But the main thing that we're building towards and the main thing that we're focusing on is the demonstration on the 3rd. And also one of the things that Resist FTA is trying to do is include some of the current issues that are going on in Toronto and in Canada and in the world in general in our demands. So, for example, as well as like being against the FTA and other agreements like that, we're also asking for the abolishment of Bill C-63, which is the new immigration bill that's coming in. And also we're supporting some anti-poverty groups in Toronto and across the country have asked that federal spending for housing be increased by 1%, which is $2 billion. And so we're also asking for that and including that. And we're also including the restoration of land rights of Indigenous people in sort of what we're asking for, just in terms of the focus and what the idea is behind our group and the demonstration. Okay, so I just want to talk for a couple minutes about some of the barriers I think that we had to organizing, and just different ideas about organizing against free trade. I think one of the big barriers against organizing against it is that it's not, a lot of people don't feel like that it's a local issue or that it addresses local concerns, and they just, it seems like it's just this big, huge, overarching, unreachable agreement that is impossible to combat. And so I think that's really hard to get people involved, because it feels like it's hard to make any gains or build resistance that's going to put a dent in it. So I think that's one of the major barriers that we felt when we were organizing, just what type of things we could do that would be effective and inspiring to the people that would participate in them. And also, I think now with this civil society part of it, it's sort of like, it's a place where some of the groups that used to sort of resist these agreements now sort of are just like, well, it's already happened. Look at, there's NAFTA, there's like APEC, WTO, whatever. The best that we can do is try and cooperate and tell them our concerns and, you know, hope that they'll kick down us a couple like clauses for social protection in the FTAA. So focus is going away from more militant or direct tactics and more towards like, if you can't beat them, join them type thing. And also, I think, I think that's, those are the basic barriers, and also the fact that these things usually start their short campaign. So the FTA comes to town, everyone's like, oh God, the FTA is coming to Toronto. We have to try and, you know, stir up some stuff and make them see that there's people out there that don't like free trade. And then you start a campaign, and then it's really short, and then it ends. And it's sort of hard to build a consistent movement in one place against this. And then also I think tactically, I think the way that people organize against free trade tactically sometimes has the flavor of people feeling like they've already lost before they've even started. Like in some ways I feel like the flavor of the November 4th demo is very much like, we don't want to be too pushy and we're sort of just going to go and have a rally, and that's what we do. We go and have rallies when people that we don't like or things that we don't like happen, and we don't really think that they're going to listen to us, but it's almost like the role that you end up playing. And I think that that's a big barrier, that people just start to feel like they can't push, or they're not actually trying to make gains, or they can't actually try and disrupt the America's Business Forum or try and disrupt the FTAA. And I think that's really scary to see that, and it's just not very hopeful to me to see that in activist groups and movements when it feels like people know that they've lost almost before they've even started, or that's how they feel. And so I think that's also what our group was trying to work against, like look where we could actually make change. And then there's also the sort of the problem between putting effort into organizing locally and organizing nationally or internationally. And I think you can definitely do both, but there's a lot of energy put into moving people to like Seattle or whatever to fight the WTO. And sometimes I think in individual cities and individual places, people don't get mobilized as much as they could, even though it's definitely important for everybody to go to one place and meet each other and feel power in numbers. I think that also sometimes poses a problem.
There's two things I was going to talk about, some of the trials and tribulations. I think Serena just mentioned there's a bit of problems sometimes with the different groups that are organizing against things like the FTAA. And there's a group called the Hemispheric Social Alliance, which is representatives of different trade unions, whatnot, throughout the Americas. In Toronto, it's put together by this group called Common Frontiers, who is part of the union organizing there. And their general attitude is that they're having an alternative conference beforehand, and what they want to do is present a series of issues that they want put into the free trade box. They're not saying that they don't want the free trade area of the Americas to happen, but they just want to inject their agenda into the FTAA. But we already know that the FTAA has been going on for, you know, that agenda's been going on for 50 years, 20 years, whatever. This is just, you know, coming in at the last minute is not going to change anything at all. So that's been a bit of a problem. And the problem is that, you know, say on the November 4th rally, you know, they don't want us to be, they don't want to be involved in anything which would jeopardize their talks. And we don't really think that's, I mean, it might make some gains, but it's not really sort of addressing the problem. So there's a bit of sort of conflict there sometimes between those different interests. The other thing I was going to talk about was just in terms of organizing for this. I've been doing some work with the MNSJ group as well. Been very sort of central on the whole issue of like these are our jobs up here. They're being taken down to Mexico or whatnot. We're losing them, and so a lot of that was played out, and that left a really bad taste in a lot of people's mouths. So that was sort of a difficulty I've had to sort of overcome in getting people to sort of work together on the FTAA. So that's a bit of a legacy, which I guess we have to work on as well. And that's part of the reason why the Resist FTA group was formed, so that we could address those issues a little bit more loudly.
Okay. Yeah, that's sort of what I was just going to get into, the problem. Sure. No. It's a good lead-up.
Excellent.
There's definitely nationalist overtones. Like, if we're talking in terms of people that live in Canada, so we have to talk about, okay, so what are we going to do about free trade as people that live in Canada? And I think that in Canada, we're very much like a lot of the more mainstream groups that are resisting the FTAA and free trade are basically like Canada is a Canada is a victim of like the big superpower America, just like countries in South America or just like Mexico. And that was the same sort of analysis that was going on during NAFTA. And I think that's really, I don't know, I find it really scary because I think in most ways our perspective as people that live in Canada or our position is much more similar to people that live in the U.S. in terms of indeed the poor people that live in these countries, their standards for wages and quality of life and social standards in general are driven down, as well as the environmental costs of free trade. But it's just very different because we're pretty much a successful capitalist country or whatever. Our quality of life is much better than people in South America. We just are in a better position. And so I think that we definitely have to try and move away from the idea that it's just America is a monster and people that live in Canada or the Canadian government are just getting screwed by America too. So I think that's really important for people to start thinking about and talking about, especially in order to combat those sort of ideas that are happening in the more mainstream liberal anti-free trade thought. And then, I don't know, that was pretty much what I had. So, yeah.
There's the poster.
Yeah, it's sort of like, oh, the U.S., we're so, you know, the Canadian government is just letting the monster U.S. ruin our lives, you know, and it's just like, I think that it's, ugh. I don't know. I was very sad when I saw that poster.
We'll pass it.
Yeah, so.
We'll pass it around later. Go for it.
Cool. So next we're going to pass it over to Jaggi Singh.
Okay. Thanks, Helen, and thanks to Serena and Brian for coming. Serena and Brian have just spoken about the FTAA, or the Free Trade Area of the Americas. The other thing, I guess, that's on the plate this fall in terms of the corporate globalization agenda is the World Trade Organization, and myself, Stefan, and Pierre, and one way or another, are going to address that. In the presentation I gave about 2 weeks ago and other presentations I've given, I've always used the analogy of globalization as colonization and trying to see the big picture and seeing this as part of a bigger process. It's not something new. It's not an aberration to our constitutions and to our economic and political identities. It very much is a process that is inherent with colonialism and imperialism and capitalism. So the FTAA and WTO aren't necessarily new things, but they are on the plate this fall, and there's going to be a lot in the media and elsewhere about these acronyms. So I'm going to give a little introduction to the WTO and what it is, and then I'm going to try to, since the purpose of this evening is to talk a little bit about strategies and alternatives and actions, to give some perspective on that. I just came back from Seattle and Olympia, Washington, just this past weekend, where I was able to plug into a lot of the activism there, and I'll try to share that with you. And unlike, well, some people might think my presentation 2 weeks ago was pretty opinionated, but I try to tone it down, but this one will be much more opinionated because I feel we have to be opinionated if we're going to get serious about how to confront corporate globalization and get serious about how to change the world for the better. So let me start, and I don't have much time, so I might be talking a bit fast. If it's too fast, slow me down. I'll start with the World Trade Organization and what it is. I mentioned in the presentation before that we had these what I call the fraternal twins of global finance, the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, and the World Bank. Well, they're actually triplets. There was something called GATT, the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, which was an informal grouping of countries, most of the countries that make up the world, to discuss tariff barriers to trade. Well, out of that process came what was the Uruguay round, where they started turning their attention to so-called non-tariff barriers to trade, as opposed to just tariff barriers to trade. And they created the World Trade Organization in 1995, which comprises 134 countries, about 30 who want to enter. So basically the entire world, except for a few exceptions. Within the agenda of the World Trade Organizations, there are such things as the GATS, the General Agreement on Trade and Services, TRIPS, the trade-related international property rights, which deals with patents and copyrights and trademarks. And we talk about TRIPS, or intellectual property rights, we aren't just talking about CDs and movies and software and who controls, you know, the rights to those things. We're also talking about life forms and patents on life and seeds and trees and that kind of stuff. So while, as I said, the GATT dealt with so-called tariff barriers, the WTO's job out of the Uruguay round is to deal with so-called non-tariff barriers. And what are those non-tariff barriers? Often, when you read the business pages, things sound so nice or so innocuous. Well, non-tariff barriers are things like subsidies that governments provide to industries, subsidies in general, and a subsidy can include healthcare, education, any sort of public spending, standards for products, government procurements. Those are the non-tariff barriers. The basic agenda at the WTO deals with really all aspects of our life, literally. We're talking about the air we breathe, the food that we eat, the kind of education that we can have, the kind of healthcare we want. The basic agenda at the World Trade Organization is agriculture, services, which again seems innocuous, but services includes healthcare and education. We're talking about intellectual property. The World Trade Organization also sets standards for pharmaceuticals and for food, international standards that the world is supposed to live up to. And if you're supposed to be part of this global economy, you have to adhere to them. Corporate lobbyists, of course, dominate this World Trade Organization agenda, much like, you know, like parasites, because this organization operates quite secretively, non-transparently, run by bureaucrats in Geneva with occasional meetings, such as the one that's happening in Seattle this fall. People might remember the MAI, the Multilateral Agreement on Investment. When we're talking about these international treaties and institutions, there's a basic division between trade and investment. And NAFTA is a good example of a trade and investment treaty. The WTO simply deals with trade, but the MAI has been thrown onto the plate at the WTO as well. And now they're talking about a multilateral framework on investment. So if you're wondering where the MAI went, and before people get too happy and congratulate ourselves for engaging in some effective grassroots campaigns and stopping the MAI, remember that it's been thrown to the WTO. again, like I said, it quite literally has impacts on all areas of our lives. And I'll just quote two sources to give you an idea what the WTO is on about. The first is a guy by the name of Renato Ruggerio, who was the former head of the WTO. And he said, in talking about the WTO, that we are doing no less than writing the constitution of a single global economy. That's how he views the World Trade Organization. And according to the current head of the World Trade Organization, a person by the name of Mike Moore, in referring to the upcoming meetings in Seattle, which have been dubbed the Millennium Round of talks, he said, we are doing no less in Seattle than defining the direction of trade relations for the next millennium. So obviously, it's a very important meeting. But I preface all that by saying these are processes that have been going on, you know, for hundreds of years. So that's something to keep in mind. Now, there's a wide-ranging critique that you can make about the WTO and why it's such a bad thing. There's a fundamental critique, I guess, or the more wide-ranging critique, and then the more narrow critique. And the more narrow critique looks at how the WTO is functioning and sort of provides examples of how bad it is. For example, on a very basic level, the WTO is supposed to deal with trade disputes between countries. And consistently, in its rulings, the WTO has a tribunal made up of bureaucrats that rule on these issues, consistently has made rulings that are to the detriment of the environment, of health, and labor standards. There are some famous cases. For example, European Union banned hormone-treated beef from the United States for health reasons. They felt that treating beef with hormones wasn't good for the health of Europeans. Well, the U.S. Took it to the World Trade Organization, and they won. The government of Venezuela took the United States to court over their Clean Air Act because Venezuela felt it threatened their sale of oil to the United States. And again, they won. And provisions of the Clean Air Act in the United States had to be changed. The U.S. passed regulations to deal with protection of sea turtles and dolphins, and in the production of tuna, making sure that nets wouldn't take in dolphins and sea turtles and cause them to eventually become extinct. Well, nations that are engaged pretty heavily in the production of tuna took it to the World Trade Organization, and again, they won. And I can go on and on with these examples. So that's one level on which you can make a critique. Another level is the same criticism that you can make critiques about any of this what I call the alphabet soup, you know, APEC or IMF or NAFTA or the FTAA. These organizations are bureaucratic, they're secretive, they're dominated by corporate lobbyists. It's difficult, if not impossible, to have popular consultation, and they're often passed without popular consent. But there's, a more fundamental, more wide-ranging critique, which I addressed a little bit 2 weeks ago, but some people might not have been there. I made this analogy about colonization. And, you know, there's a worldview that motivates organizations like the WTO or why people who are proponents of the FTAA. It's an ideology, it's a worldview that sees everything as having a dollar value. We're not human beings, we're human capital. We don't talk about the ecology or the environment, we talk about natural resources. And that becomes very insidious at the level of the WTO, where things like seeds or basmati rice or curry or soya beans, they all are being patented, and these things that are part of a communal heritage that we all own are now being patented by companies so that they can sell the seeds for rice, say, or sell the rights to produce these things to people who have been growing these things for many, many years. One anarchist said quite famously that property is theft. Well, at the WTO, you see how that's becoming very much entrenched. Communal property, things that belong to all of us, are getting dollar values on them and are being owned by corporations, and this is propped up by the World Trade Organization. And it's not so much that we're talking about property rights over human rights or property rights over environmental rights. What's happening at institutions like the World Trade Organization is that we're talking about property rights as a human right. That is the most basic human right. And again, we have to challenge this worldview behind it. And that gets me into talking a little bit about alternatives. I guess before doing that, I'll talk about Seattle, since I was just there, maybe give you some flavor of what's happening. The Seattle meetings are taking place between November 29th and December 3rd. They've been dubbed the Millennium Round. All the trade ministers from these 134 countries and other countries that want to join the WTO will be there. It's one of Bill Clinton's last hurrahs before he flies off into the sunset, goes back to Arkansas or wherever he's going. It's really the largest trade meeting to ever be held in history. And of course, we're here to talk about alternatives and actions, and maybe I should talk about some of the more positive things and what's being organized against the World Trade Organization. I guess before doing that, I should maybe say give some flavor about Seattle. The two people who have been named the co-chairs of the World Trade Organization, this gives you an idea. Serena and Brian talked about the America's Business Forum in the FTAA. Well, the two co-chairs, the hosts of the World Trade Organization in Seattle will be Bill Gates, president of Microsoft, and Phil Condit, who's the president of Boeing, two large multinational corporations. I use this term free market Jesuits, or I've used the term before to refer to how proponents of the free market like to get people while they're young and try to have them for the rest of their lives. Well, the propaganda and the campaigns and the PR is just astounding. For example, out of the University of Washington in Seattle, they're running this WTO ambassadors program where they're training young business students on the WTO and getting them out into high schools and teaching people about how great things are. There's this citizens petition that I found, which is Workers and Families for Free Trade. And they play up all these statistics about how one-third of all jobs in Washington State, up there in Seattle, are dependent on free trade. But they also say things like, whereas Japan, this is a petition, whereas Japan, China, South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Thailand, and Singapore are among our largest trading partners and represent the greatest opportunity for evangelism and mission outreach. Whereas we as Americans support democracy, freedom, and capitalism, be it resolved that we believe free trade can spread economic prosperity and individual and religious freedoms throughout the world, we encourage U.S. and world officials to stand firm for our shared values in the face of vocal anti-capitalist protests scheduled for Seattle during the World Trade Organization. Now, when I talk about globalization as colonization or globalization as imperialism, you know, I don't have to go too far. It's not as if I'm being radical here. When I present this, you know, we're supporting freedom, democracy, capitalism. It presents an opportunity to promote our values. What are our values? Well, the American way. And it's really quite stark here. There's a lot of hype in the media, in the mainstream media in Seattle, but also elsewhere about potential demonstrations. A lot of it just totally made up. Because on June 18th this year, there was International Day Against Globalization organized by Reclaim the Streets. Well, November 30th has been proclaimed another International Day of Action. So if you can't go to Seattle, people are being encouraged to organize actions in their own localities that target local financial institutions or local symbols of capitalism or globalization. Well, there's been a lot of hype about riots organized by anarchists or stockpiling of arms, which are, again, totally made up. A lot of it is, you know, similar to what we see wherever these spectacles of capital meet. For example, the FBI now is looking into the Freemamia group in Seattle, and they've made up something about them threatening a group, and that's being seen by a lot of activists in Seattle as being an excuse for the FBI to clamp down on activist groups. And well, I won't have the time to go into it, but ask me about the FBI clamping down on activist groups in United States history, and it's a pretty scary history. Recently, the city council in Seattle passed a noise ordinance that prevents people from making noise where it can be heard within 50 meters of a commercial institution. And this is very specific. It's seen specifically as being a way of clamping down on having effective protests against the World Trade Organization in Seattle. But of course, there are responses, and I guess I can describe them. I was talking about the World Trade Organization. I guess you can describe the opposition, quote unquote, because I don't consider, I don't consider a lot of what passes for opposition to really be opposition. But there's sort of three alternatives to the World Trade Organization. They can be described as people who are proponents of social clauses, the people who are calling for a review, and the people who are saying, reject the WTO, let's build other alternatives. People who are calling for social clauses, which a lot of labor unions and activist groups are calling for within the free trade area of the Americas. And let's get specific. This includes groups in Quebec, such as the CSN, the FTQ, the Réseau Québécois sur l'Intégration Continentale. They're all participating within something called the Hemispheric Social Alliance, which, while it's very critical of globalization, of course, and while it's made up of some very good people who do some very good actions, have basically accepted the fact that the free trade area of the Americas is a reality, and they want to bring in social clauses, environmental clauses, and human rights clauses. I'll provide a critique of that if I can. Serena's and Brian have done a good job, but I'll just leave it at that. That's one position. Another position by groups like Public Citizen, which is a Ralph Nader-inspired group in the United States, and other groups are calling for a review of the WTO. So they don't want any more talks until what's happened so far is reviewed. Which sounds good as well, but as a speaker said at the conference, a speaker who happens to be from the South, people in Mexico, people in the maquiladoras, indigenous peoples, people who are on the other side of what globalization is about, have already given their review. It's a bit presumptuous to say, well, let's let these people review and let's see what happens. That sort of is telling us to just, you know, be quiet while we do a review. In any case, that's a second position. And a third position is, of course, to reject the WTO and to provide coherent alternatives. In terms of what's happening in Seattle, there are, of course, whenever these organizations like the WTO or APEC or the FTAA meet, there's always NGOs that meet, and they have what's been critically called by some the NGO Olympics. You know, they fly in people from all over the world. They have talks and things, and a lot of that is good. It'll be talking about alternatives, and of course, in Seattle is going to be a meeting point for activists all over the world. There's going to be a huge teach-in organized by the International Forum on Globalization with speakers from the South as well as from the North. Some of the more prominent speakers include Vandana Shiva from India. So that's happening. There's also people who want to negotiate within the WTO. And again, it's important to point out who is doing this so that we know on what side of the issue people stand. The big labor organization in the United States, the American Federation of Labor, also known as the AFL-CIO, they've been called by some the AFL-CIA, but you can ask me about that later on. They, along with the Sierra Club of the United States and some other big NGOs, are pushing for a space within the WTO to agitate for social clauses. And Bill Clinton, the trade representative of the U.S., Charlene Barshefsky, they've been quite receptive. They don't really feel threatened by it, and they've provided a space for them to be able to put forward their point of view. When I was at this conference in Seattle, I've been critical about labor unions in Canada, but listening to labor organizers and union leaders in the U.S., they make labor people in Canada look like raving communists compared to some of the things they were saying. One organizer in the States in particular, you know, his speech was full of the nationalism that Serena talked about, but from an American perspective, you know, our jobs, our sovereignty, this and that. And if you took two sentences, literally, if you took two sentences out of his speech, it's a speech that could have been given by someone like Pat Buchanan. That's how right-wing, that's how nationalistic and jingoistic it was. And these people are on the forefront of organizing against the WTO. So these are things to be aware of when we're discussing alternatives and strategies. As one speaker said at the conference that I was at, it's a basic point. There's been no major social change in world history without taking to the streets or taking to the fields or taking to the factories. There has to be a social cost. Otherwise, the people who are the proponents of these agendas will pass them or co-opt people who aren't willing to provide a social cost. So there's going to be a very strong direct action component. I have postcards here. I don't have enough to go around. Actually, I won't pass them out. They're more for display. It's a direct action, a large direct action call from November 30th against the WTO. On that day, Bill Clinton is going to be at the Paramount Theater in Seattle, waiting as the limousines of all these corporate lobbyists and bureaucrats and trade ministers come, and he's going to shake their hands. Well, according to these direct action activists, that's not going to happen. What they want to do is block the limousines, engage in mass-scale direct actions to really show quite clearly to people that we oppose this agenda and that we oppose it so much that it shouldn't happen. And that's one part of what's happening in Seattle. I have a lot more stuff, but I'm going to skip over it. Maybe during question period we can bring it up, but some of the other posters and flavor of what's happening in Seattle, some good, some bad, some just really weird. I guess in talking about alternatives in the minute or so I have left, I want to say a few things. One is that you can be opinionated and you can be critical and you can have an analysis and you can still be effective. That's something that we're taught can't be true. Somehow you have to tone down your rhetoric. You have to you have to hold back. Otherwise you won't be effective. I think you can be both. It's important to be really clear and honest about where people are coming from. And as Sunera Tabani, who used to be the head of the National Action Committee on the Status of Women, said in Seattle during this conference, it's important to know what side people are on when we're dealing with issues like imperialism and colonization and those sorts of things. Also, you can be radical and talk about these things and advocate radical tactics, and you can still be strategic and tactical. It's not as if we're talking about pushing something down people's throats. So, for example, around the WTO, we can be very, very strategic and tactical. Sure, there are some people who are asking for social clauses. Sure, there are some people who want to negotiate within the agenda, but there are issues on which we can agree and consider a bottom line. And that was made quite clear by, again, Sunera Tabani at this conference, where she said, I think there's three areas where, when we're dealing with the WTO, where we could perhaps agree. One is to get agriculture out of the WTO. That is, that there's absolutely no compromise when it comes to food security. We should not be fooling around with food and people's ability to have food security. This is a huge issue in the South. We're dealing with people's lives here, and there should be no playing around or commodifying of food. The second is that there should be absolutely no patents on life, period. Animal life, plant life, or human life. That should be taken out of the WTO. And that's another bottom line where groups have to define themselves. Are they for that or are they against that? The third issue, which is perhaps a bit more controversial, but again, is a bottom line for people like Sunera and myself and activists all over the world, and that is clear support for indigenous sovereignty, the right to self-determination, because these agendas are basically continuing the process of genocide of indigenous peoples by another means. I don't have the time to fill that in and to give and maybe convince you if you're not convinced, but that's important. Sunera said that we should, in Quebec, this brings on another connotation, but we should think big. I think of Elvis Graton when I hear that phrase. But we should think big. We should confront this agenda by looking at the worldview behind it and not being dishonest to where we're coming from. I'll just end by making two quotes. One is going back to those APEC protests. I want to quote from the National Post. The APEC stuff has blown up recently, and there was a certain validation of where a lot of us so-called radical protesters were coming from no other source than the National Post, or what I call the National Compost. And this is a news, I'm going to quote the first two paragraphs of a news story, okay? The writer says, the young protesters who triggered the RCMP public complaints inquiry into police actions at APEC are easy not to like. They're easy not to like. They're scruffy, irreverent, disruptive, disrespectful of authority, and cynical about this great country of ours. That's paragraph number one. Paragraph number two is, and uncomfortable as it may be to accept, they just might be right. So that's a certain validation of sticking to a point of view, a radical point of view, and, well, no less a source than the National Post is validating it. And I guess I'll end up by quoting from someone I haven't quoted from before, and that is a person by the name of Moses Havini, who is an activist from a small island off of the coast of New Guinea called Bougainville. And they've been fighting for decades. He calls his land the biggest hole in the earth because mining companies such as Rio Tinto and CRZ, these multinational mining companies, have basically exploited these people for decades. They've hired militias, private armies to basically quell any sort of hope for self-determination. And he said at another conference that I was at recently that when injustice becomes law, resistance becomes duty. I think that's the basic premise, or that's the basic view that we should uphold. Injustice is becoming, when injustice becomes law, resistance becomes duty. These aren't just some small policy shifts. These aren't just some little things that are being changed. These go to the heart of what kind of society we want to live in. And they go to the heart of resistance that have been taking place for over 500 years. And I guess I'll just end up with that we should realize where our duty lies, and our tactics and our strategies and our actions will follow. I'm sorry for going overboard. Yeah.
I won't repeat what all the other people have said on the analysis we make of the WTO attack is involved in a campaign against the talks at the Millennium Round of the WTO, so I won't dwell on that in terms of our action as attack. What is attack, first of all? Let's start with that. In French, it means association pour une taxe sur les transactions financières d'aide aux citoyens, which can be translated by an association for a citizen's tax on financial transactions. Why do we want a tax? Everybody's calling for tax cuts. We see it all over the place, especially big business, in fact. And we're calling for another tax. It's called the Tobin tax. I'm sure you've heard about it. The history of the Tobin tax is interesting, because it shows how the people's movement and the resistance to financial capital is growing. When Tobin put that forward in 1972-73, his aim was essentially to sort of regulate speculation in the financial markets so that the countries, the central banks, would not see the le devise, the value of their currency go up and down, and because that was seen as an impediment to trade and whatever. So since Nixon had taken off what they call the gold
standard.
The gold standard, the currencies were going all over the place. So Tobin put forward that we should try to regulate that and make sure that the currencies would not go up and down. He had not intended at all to raise money for development or whatever. But that idea was never. There was a big silence over that idea because it went against the laws of capital, that free flow of capital, free flow investment, whatever. You don't try to regulate that. So it's only later on in the late 80s, beginning of the 90s, that this idea came back because it was at the UN. The United States had accumulated a debt about more than $1 billion towards the UN. And different agencies within the UN started saying, well, we need autonomous financing. That doesn't make sense that we don't have any money to do our programs or all that, and our organization should have our own financing. They talked about lotteries. They talked about what they call green taxes on fuel, on international transportation, and whatever. And the Tobin tax came back up also. And there were a lot of discussions and whatever. 1996 or 97, I don't remember the exact dates, but anyhow, a Republican congressman in the States tried to push a law to say that the United States would stop funding any UN organization that would put forward autonomous financing. It was seen as something that would take away the power, especially with the United States, to control the UN and its agencies by undercutting the financing by the member countries. So that's the little story of the idea. And since they stopped at the UN discussing it, the different ONGs have started putting forward that idea. Is it a good idea, and why should we try to implement it? Well, the basic thing about what's happening is that, as you know, financial capital has been growing and growing since, especially in the 1970s with the oil crisis and all that, the pension funds, at a point where now the money that's going back and forth every day is about $1.5 trillion, of which merely 3 to 10% represent real trade. The rest is just paper money. Paper money does not create wealth. It is a claim on wealth. It is a claim on what we produce. So that when you have more and more money circulating, speculating on currencies, what they do is that they'll buy, I don't know, the yen at 10 o'clock in the morning, sell it back 12 o'clock, hoping that they'll get a small percentage on the difference between what they buy and what they sell, and therefore they're using billions and billions of dollars doing that, and they're making billions and billions of dollars of profit. But what that does, as we've seen in Mexico, what we've seen in Indonesia and Thailand, is that they speculate, and when they feel that the currency is going down, they rush the capital out, the currency plunges, and it provokes financial chaos, economic recession, and what have you. So we have a situation where the financial capital, the financial flows, are so strong that they control the real economy without producing any wealth. In fact, they're like Draculas sucking the blood of the wealth and our economies. Secondly, what the impact that it has is on a certain form, if we can still talk about national sovereignty in the world we live in, but it takes away a part of the control that the different states have on their own currency. And therefore, your interest rates, for example, like in Canada, when we had the rush on the Canadian dollar, when our dollar went down to 64, 63 cents about a year and a half ago, our interest rates go up. So what kind of economic policy do you have when you're just a puppet in the hands of the large financial markets? So the idea of the Tobin tax, which we're putting forward, is essentially just to put, as Tobin said, a grain of sand in the wheels of speculation. It will not stop speculation. I don't think we can dream of stopping speculation without abolishing capital. But what do we do in the meantime is try to put a price on speculation, saying, okay, you can cross borders with your capital, but we're going to tax you 0.01% or 0.2% on whatever transactions you can make. And since the level of profit they make on each transaction is quite low, that and they go back and forth maybe 2-3 times a day, then 15 times a week, 100 times a month, it amounts to a very large tax, to the point that we've calculated that it could bring about $160 billion a year. A very, very small tax could bring $160 billion a year, which is about 4 times the amount that the UN organizations have calculated to eradicate poverty in the world. So it's a large amount of money. So you can understand that there's a very large resistance to that type of very reformist, rational measure as a small tax like that. The main arguments that are presented, there are arguments from the right and arguments from the left. The arguments from the right say that you should not tax capital. You cannot do that. That will hinder economic development. Free-flowing financial flows are the best thing you can have for the economy. And they also say that it's not a practical thing, that you cannot, if you have it in London or in Frankfurt, you don't have it in the Caribbean, all the flows will go through the Caribbean and they'll just trickle through and your tax won't have any efficiency. So that's one of the arguments put forward. The second argument is saying that capital doesn't function like that. They won't accept. Nobody will accept that. There was even a demonstration in Brazil of the liboursicata, the people on the stock market, the traders, who demonstrated for about, I don't know, 15 minutes or something like that, to stop trading and against the Brazilian government that wanted to impose a certain control of capital flows. So it goes as far as these small traders who are not the millionaires but who are trying to say no, we won't accept this. So you can imagine what's happening in the large boardrooms. On the left, we have the critique that says that to tax financial flows or to tax speculation is to condone speculation. That is to say, is to accept it, and it's like taxing cigarettes. It's not because we're taxing cigarettes that we're against the health hazard that it represents. So the idea is that the tax would be more a patch on something you cannot patch. So why are we putting forward that idea and why are we struggling for it? Well, first, we're not the only ones. The movement started in France in 1997 with an editorial in Le Monde Diplomatique, which is probably the most influential journal in the French-speaking media in terms of its analysis of the world situation. And trade unions and non-governmental organizations, to a point where now in France you have 12,000 people who are member of ATTAC. You have ATTAC groups in Italy. You have ATTAC groups in Switzerland, in Belgium, in Finland, in Brazil. I know the Tobin tax movement is growing in the United States. At the European Parliament, there are 80 members of parliament who have an ATTAC caucus, trying to push forward that at the European level, there would be a Tobin tax imposed on financial flows. The Canada, surprisingly enough, in March of this year, voted a motion to put forward the Tobin tax in the international scene. It was presented by the NDP Member of Parliament, Lauren Nystrom, was defended by some members of the Bloc Québécois, and was voted on by the members of the Liberal Party. Even Paul Martin voted for that, saying that it was a good idea. You cannot be against apple pie, and that they would vote for it. So it's interesting to see that one of the reasons we feel that Canada adopted that, and they're doing nothing around that. Even the people, les fonctionnaires, the civil servants, have been told not to discuss this tax with when they go at the G7 or at the OCDE or in the international meetings. So they're really just giving it lip service to sort of downtone the movements that the lobbying that has been done, especially in English Canada. And I'll come back to that aspect of the problem. So we're part, therefore, of a growing international movement trying to, with our very modest energies, to put just this grain of sand in the wheels of speculation. Up till now, we know that Finland is looking into voting that. The Parliament in France just debated such a question. It was not adopted, but they've decided to study it more. But which is a victory in itself, because the French socialist government has always refused to discuss it in the past, saying that it was not realistic or whatever. So we're seeing that, and in Brazil also, members of parliament, there's a caucus there that is pushing the idea. So we're seeing the movement growing more and more, and therefore we're very much encouraged. In English Canada, maybe you know more about what happened in English Canada than I do, but what I know is that the Halifax Initiative coalition that was created around the G7 talks in Halifax in 95 lobbied very strongly with the Sierra Club and all those, and was able to have the motion passed, as I described it before, in March of this year. In Quebec, we have just started our work, and we're very encouraged by the results. But the main problem we have at the organizational level is the absence of links between what's happening in French Canada on the Tobin tax and in English Canada. There are no organizational links, no joint efforts, no joint campaigns. And one of the reasons I was very happy to talk here tonight is to try to bridge the gap and try to have to link up the movement in Quebec and the movement in English Canada. So, and as I said before, ATTAC is not only around the Tobin tax. We're trying to work along all the lines of going against neoliberalism, domination of financial capital on the real economy, against the attack on the environments. Again, so ATTAC, just to make clear, is not just a Tobin tax grouping or movement. Thank you.